The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Afghans fleeing their country are starting to arrive in the U.S., torn between their new beginning and the people they've left behind with an uncertain future.
I am very lucky that I am here safe, but sometimes think that I made a big mistake.
You made a mistake?
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, when I am thinking you have made your family in danger.
Afghanistan also looms over Vice President Kamala Harris's trip to Southeast Asia. There could be a trade-off with the current chaos.
I think the withdrawal from Afghanistan will certainly strengthen the U.S. ability to rally support to better compete with China.
I'm Marco Werman, and in Brazil, politics take a back seat to health.
Brazilians traditionally are very adherent to vaccination.
Even as the Brazilian president shrugs off vaccines. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Thanks for joining us today. President Biden is standing firm on his timeline for the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, August 31st. That is 1 week from today. The decision by the president comes despite pleas this morning from American allies. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that an emergency meeting of the G7 today reached an agreement on a Kabul evacuation plan and a roadmap for engaging with the Taliban.
The number one condition we're setting as G7, is that they've got to guarantee right the way through August the 31st and beyond, safe passage for those who want to come out.
The Prime Minister made those comments in an interview with the Guardian newspaper. Some European nations have said they won't be able to evacuate at-risk Afghans by the August 31st deadline, and they will have to shut down their own evacuations if the U.S. withdraws the troops currently protecting the Kabul airport. The Taliban today reiterated that they would not agree to any extension of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Here's Taliban spokesman Sahail Shaheen in an interview with the British broadcaster Sky yesterday.
If they are intent on continuing the occupation, so it will provoke a reaction.
The U.S. continues airlifts out of the Kabul airport in a race against the clock. Major General Hank Taylor updated the numbers in a press conference today.
To date, 63,900 American citizens, NATO and other partners, personnel, Afghan SIV applicants, and vulnerable Afghans are out of harm's way. Now safer and on their journey to a better life.
Afghans fleeing Taliban rule are starting to arrive in the U.S. Many are beginning a new chapter of life in apartments, often arranged by refugee resettlement agencies, in places like Sacramento, California, one of the larger Afghan-American communities in the U.S. That's where The World's Monica Campbell takes us now to meet one newly arrived family. For security reasons, they asked not to use their names.
Put my shoes here.
The family's new apartment is on the second floor of a maze-like lower-income complex. It's barely furnished, but bit by bit, it's becoming home. The father shows me donated mattresses.
These mattresses, I have not gotten the bed yet. No worries, for now we are managing.
And then here you have the pressure cooker,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, pressure cooker, yeah. We call it digable hot.
A friend gave it to them secondhand, and you can tell it's been used a lot, well-loved. And it's tinier than the one the family had back in Afghanistan.
It's smaller, you know. In our culture, in our tradition, families are not 3 or 6 members. My family is 17 members.
17?
Yeah.
In Afghanistan, they all lived next to each other and ate together. Here in California, the family has shrunk down to mom, dad, their 2-year-old girl, and their son. He's 5. They fled just hours before Kabul fell. They'd received special immigrant visas based on the work the father did for the Afghan military and the U.S. That made him a Taliban target. Already, the father says the Taliban have gone to their home in Kabul, perhaps looking for him.
about 16 or 15 Taliban. They had came to our gate and they were knocking.
He says his mom told the armed group that there were no men inside and they went away. Threats like that are keeping the couple awake at night here in California. The mom, she's 27, is also torn up thinking about how life is changing for women back home. Her sisters and friends don't feel safe leaving the house alone. They can't go and walk to the bazaars like before, she says. And she can't reach out to her friends to see how they're doing because only a few people know she's left Afghanistan. She looks down and touches the rug we're sitting on. It's deep red and elegant. It reminds her of home. A friend bought them the rug and a TV. A family friend who left Afghanistan a few years back and now lives in Sacramento too. The father says they're receiving advice from the community here, from Afghans who've resettled here over the years, and know how difficult these first few days can be. They tell him,
don't be sad. You will be good in future. You will have your own house, and all the things will be good, great.
While the couple speaks, their two kids play. Their five-year-old son pedals a donated red tricycle down the hallway. He'll start school soon. Their two-year-old daughter is watching an Afghan music video on her dad's phone. That phone also has messages from her father's former co-workers, now scrambling to leave Afghanistan themselves, trying to enter the Kabul airport. He plays me the messages he's getting.
Is your phone filled with these messages?
Yeah.
The father thinks the U.S. could have left Afghanistan in a better way.
The U.S. government could prevent this situation which has happened right now. It could be managed better.
He says he feels guilty being in the U.S.
I am very lucky that I am here safe. But sometimes think that I made a big mistake.
You made a mistake?
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, when I am thinking you have made your family in danger. Mm. It would be better to be at their side, whatever happened.
He's talking about the family he left in Afghanistan. But then he remembers how his life felt increasingly under threat as the Taliban gained power. He started switching up his routine to work to avoid being followed. He stopped seeing friends as much, stopped exercising outdoors.
The life that we were living there, that was not life.
Not a safe life. Here in California, they feel freer. Later, after I left, the father texted me, telling me they'd gone for their regular evening walk to a nearby park to let the kids run around, something they no longer felt safe doing back home. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell in Sacramento, California.
A world leader sowing mistrust about the COVID-19 vaccine. We've seen this in a number of countries, but right now we're talking specifically about Brazil. President Jair Bolsonaro has been vocal about his mistrust of vaccines, and yet Brazil has actually embraced the jab of various sorts. According to a recent poll, 90% of Brazilians say they plan on getting their shots. I'm joined now by Professor Margaret Dalcomo. She's a pulmonologist and researcher at the National School of Public Health of Brazil's Oswaldo Cruz Foundation. Professor Dalcomo, I mean, despite mixed messages from Bolsonaro and others, Brazilians seem to have embraced the vaccine. Does this surprise you?
Well, actually, you have to understand that Brazilians traditionally are very supportive with vaccines and very adherent to vaccination. So it's very surprising that we did receive the refusal, not as representative as we are seeing in Europe or even in US, but in Brazil, it really surprised us to see that some people could be convinced by, for instance, religious rhetorics, politicization in the bad sense of the vaccination process in Brazil. So for COVID-19, we are having troubles, not only in terms of people fed with fake news or bad information, but with shortage of vaccines as well. And so now we have a gap between the first and the second dose, and we need to improve the rollout of the vaccination a lot in the country as a whole.
So help us understand how, despite all of these negative messages from the president, even his rank-and-file political supporters have parted ways with Bolsonaro on vaccines. Why is that?
Well, I think he mixes up the religion and politics and fake news in wrong concepts. But he's losing prestige in Brazil, clearly, even in these terms of convincing people. People are realizing that the Delta strain, for instance, is so contagious, 5-6 times more than the original strain. And so people are receiving the good information from the press. And this is something that I have to reinforce. The Brazilian press has been providing a very good job throughout the whole pandemic. So it's not the Ministry of Health that is providing this data daily for the Brazilian population. So I personally have been participating in the press programs, TV, televisions, etc., since the early March of last year. So this is something that for me, I work in a federal institution. I have been helping the Ministry of Health since the first SARS epidemic, since the H1N1 epidemic. And so I'm used to deal with epidemics. I work in Africa as well for the World Bank project in respiratory diseases, and so I am used with epidemics.
As you said, the media in Brazil played a crucial role in public awareness of vaccinations. What is the Ministry of Health and public health officials actually doing then to spread the pro-vaccine message and raising public health awareness about it?
Well, now the Ministry of Health improved a little, but the problem is that the National Program of Immunization, it is completely dismantled. So we entered the epidemic in a very weakened situation. And so far, we do not have a centralized committee to help us to organize the whole actions. And so what is going on is that each state, each municipality in Brazil is free to take their own decisions. And so it's not something that it has been done in the same way. We should be vaccinating at least 2 million people a day. And we reached this figure some days, but not every day. Why? Because, you know, the logistic is complicated. We don't have the full support from the federal institutions and because we are having shortages of vaccines.
So, Professor, in the U.S., vaccination rates have played out largely along political lines, but that does not seem to be what's happening in Brazil, or is it?
It is similar. Oh, yes. We have never seen such level of politicization in a health problem. We have never had it. So when the president comes to a multitude of people and say, I am not going to get vaccinated, he's an example. So he takes off his masks, for instance. He takes off the masks of the children where he is. And so this is something that really makes a sort of diseducation, if I can say so, in a very bad way.
And yet, Professor, as I said, 90% of Brazilians say they are going to get vaccinated. So some of those people clearly voted for the vaccine-denying Bolsonaro.
Yes, but now it's changing. Now it is changing because we are doing a very, very frequent and heavy work. So the number of medical doctors, my colleagues and me and researchers that are going to press all the time. So we are present the whole time, giving figures, giving information and explaining people and trying to convince. We speak with the politicians, we speak with religions leaders, we are involving communities, not only to convince, but to explain and to provide true information. And so more than 90% now is convinced that they have to get vaccines, although the official rhetorics being so deconstructive in this sense.
Margaret Dalcomo is a pulmonologist from the National School of Public Health of Brazil's Oswaldo Cruz Foundation, speaking with us about Brazil's vaccination campaign. Thank you very much for your time, Professor.
It's a pleasure. Bye-bye.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Deadly flash floods that hit Western Europe last month were all the more devastating because of climate change. That's according to an analysis released today by a group of scientists in Europe and the U.S. Martin von Alst from the Red Cross Red Crescent Climate Center says that kind of flooding is still a once-in-a-400-year event. You still have to plan for it.
Into the future, the results from our study show that it's going to be even more important to take account of what are currently very low-frequency events that are getting more likely with the changing climate.
At least 220 people died in Germany and Belgium in mid-July when swollen floodwaters swept away homes, roads, and bridges. Warmer air can hold more moisture, and climate change is driving more intense rains across much of the globe. And they found that rainfall today increased by 3 to nearly 20% across a wide swath of Western Europe. The study was released today by the World Weather Attribution Network. Martin von Alst says these recent floods should teach risk managers two lessons.
I mean, the first lesson is that climate change is hitting us everywhere now. So if we want to avoid these problems from getting worse, let's reduce those greenhouse gases urgently, because that is in the end driving this rise in risk.
Already, though, the analysis found that with current levels of global warming, the kind of rains we saw in July, they're only getting more and more common. Planners, von Alst says, need to be ready for this new normal.
So the increase in risk that we found in this study are something we need to manage by thinking about our flood risk management, about our preparedness, about early warning systems being ready to tell people what's coming their way and people knowing what to do at that point.
On this side of the Atlantic, flooding in the state of Tennessee this weekend killed 22 people. A total of 17 inches of rain fell in less than 24 hours, bringing flash floods that swept away cars and destroyed homes. We're going to have a talk about Indian food now. What we're not going to do is dive into the fracas over the Washington Post columnist who incorrectly dissed Indian food as, quote, based entirely on one spice, end quote. No, we're going to explore the pleasures of Indian cuisine with food writer, cook, and photographer Nick Sharma. He moved to the States from India in his early 20s. His books include Season and The Flavor Equation. Nick joins us from Oakland. So thanks for being here, Nick. Let's talk first the range of spices you use in your cooking. And yes, you can mention curry, or should I say curries, because there are different spice mixes that make different kinds of curries, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't have a problem saying the word curry, but I have never used curry powder myself.
So what are some of the spices Americans will have heard of that go into curries?
I guess turmeric is the first thing that comes to mind.
Turmeric, yeah.
Because most curries tend to be yellow in color, at least with the curry powder that they've been using. So I know turmeric is something that is the quickest thing. The second thing I think would be cumin, and the third spice would be coriander. I would think these three spices are probably what comes to mind when people say curry.
What do you bring into your own cooking to kind of vary the different kind of curries that you make?
So I actually don't use turmeric a lot. I just think it's one of those spices that needs to be used wisely, too much, and then things start to taste pungent. But in terms of spices, I do use cumin, I do use coriander, but I also use spices like nigella, fennel, fenugreek. There's just so many spices available, and I think it's a shame to kind of restrict one's repertoire just to like a blend.
So as you know, Thailand and Japan also have curries. Are any of the kind of spices that you use in India, do they transfer over to those countries, or is that a completely different story altogether?
Oh, no, absolutely they do. Because, I mean, if you think about it, borders were something that were defined much recently. And before that, and even now, you know, the spices are still traded. And especially in Southeast Asia, where you do find a lot of these recipes that are called curries, you do have a lot of these spices that are similar or the same ones that are being used, but in different combinations and in different ways, which is what makes those dishes unique and special. So you'll see ginger and garlic, which is used in a lot of Southeast Asian cuisines to build flavor. You'll see cumin again. You'll see chilies, which is something that came from the New World to the Old World. And so you will see chilies play a significant part in these dishes.
Nick, what part of India are you from and how has that influenced your cooking?
I'm originally from Bombay on the west coast in India, but my dad's from the north of India. And then my mom's from Goa, which is on the west coast. And so my influences in cooking are very coastal, because that's what I'm most familiar with. So coconut is one of the ingredients actually that plays a huge part in my cooking.
Do you keep those influences separate, or are you inclined to kind of merge them all together?
I do what comes most naturally to me, and that is to kind of avoid thinking of things as static elements. I think of them as much more fluid and they evolve as I evolve. So that's how my cooking is. For example, if turmeric is going to benefit the flavor in the dish, then I'll use it. If not, I'll stay away from it.
India, of course, is a huge country with a lot of diversity ethnically, linguistically, culturally. What part of India does the food in most Indian restaurants in the U.S. reflect?
Typically, it usually reflects the food that is cooked from the northern parts of the country, especially on the northwestern side. So from the states of Punjab, and then a lot of Indian food that has been popularized in the West has traditionally been food from the Mughal Empire. So the Mughal influences in India, who ruled India for a really long time, a lot of that food is quite popular in restaurants.
And as an Indian immigrant in the United States, how has that influenced your recipes in terms of ingredients you use or maybe just the impulse to experiment?
It definitely creates a room for me to talk about the food that I don't see on menus, and also the food that's not traditionally spoken about in mainstream media. So I take this as an opportunity to talk about the foods that I think people should know about. For example, I use a lot of tamarind in my cooking because, again, that's something that I grew up using in my food as a souring agent. And so you'll see a lot of my recipes that will use tamarind in different ways. So I try to bring a different perspective on Indian cooking to my work.
All right, final question. Chicken tikka masala. What did you know about this dish that seems to be in every Indian restaurant in the United States before you arrived in America?
I have eaten chicken tikka masala in India. It's not that I haven't. It's just not one of those dishes that I normally reach out to on the menu. Yeah, it's just not that special to me.
Why not? Everybody loves it, it seems. I mean, is it authentic at all in India?
I mean, I feel like authenticity is something that changes with time. You know, it's something that evolves. It's a dish that was created for a specific reason in restaurants, and it's popular. So I wouldn't call it authentic, but I wouldn't also say it's not authentic because it's become a part of things over time. And I think one of the things we need to remember with food is that it evolves over time. What was once not a tradition then becomes a tradition after it's repeated again and again.
So what is your goal as a food writer and food creator living in the U.S., Nick?
My goal with food has always been to talk about the food that excites me and also to use this as a moment to teach people about new ingredients, new flavors, and hopefully, you know, this is something that they bring into their homes.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us about it. Nick Sharma, food writer, photographer, and cook. Thank you very much for being with us, Nick.
Thanks a lot.
More coming your way in the second half of the show. It's the world. In some countries, vaccination rates are up. For those at risk, they can now get back to what they love.
It's fantastic. We were closed into our apartments for quite a while.
A retirement community concert at last. And more stories. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Vice President Kamala Harris is in Vietnam today. It marks the Biden administration's first trip to Asia. One of her missions is to reassure allies in Southeast Asia of the U.S. commitment to the region. The timing is awkward as global attention is focused on the unfolding chaos in Afghanistan. It was on minds of reporters who were putting questions yesterday to Harris and Singapore's Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong.
Does the fall of Afghanistan 20 years after the U.S. started military operations there, does that change your calculus on how you can rely on America as a partner in this region, both militarily and economically?
The trusted partner question there coming from Nandita Bose from Reuters. Yoon Sun is co-director of the East Asia program at the Stimson Center in Washington. Yoon, Singapore's prime minister's answer to that question was pretty diplomatic. He said what matters now is how the U.S. repositions itself in the region. Still, there is no avoiding it. The chaos in Afghanistan has really muddied Harris's message and mission, it seems.
Yeah, well, this diplomatic trip by VP Harris certainly has come at a very unfortunate time because all the attention is being focused on the messy and chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. And I think for the countries in Southeast Asia and for the region as a whole, the primary question or the primary impression that people get is that is U.S. commitment still credible? That if U.S. can just drop Afghanistan in a moment and just pack up and leave, then what does that mean for U.S. commitment in other parts of the world? And should countries in the region should still trust when U.S. says that we are on your side and we're here to help you? So I think that is the most important ramification for VP Harris' trip. And coming from this Afghanistan experience, I think the region certainly has a lot of questions.
What countries need to be reassured of the U.S. commitment to the region, and what kind of actions are they looking for proof of that commitment?
I would say overall, the region has a relatively cynical attitude about the U.S. commitment. But I mean, for countries, especially Vietnam and the Philippines, these two countries need most U.S. reassurance and U.S. support.
And what is that reassurance going to look like when the U.S. provides it? What will make Vietnam and the Philippines happy, for example?
So I think what Philippines would like to see is that if there is indeed further escalation of dispute with China in the South China Sea because of their maritime dispute, they want to see U.S. actions. They want to see U.S. taking a solid stance that U.S. is on Manila's side. And I would say same thing with Vietnam. Although Vietnam is a more complicated case, not because of its relationship with the United States and the war that we fought with in Vietnam, but because Vietnam is still governed by a communist party. And that communist party inevitably shares a certain level of ideological affinity or loyalty with the Chinese Communist Party. So I think Vietnamese would like to see U.S. security support on the issue of South China Sea, but they also want U.S. to stay out of their domestic politics.
Some experts say the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan may be a good thing in regards to relations between the U.S. and nations in Southeast Asia. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that is a very good argument, because one of the motivations for the withdrawal from Afghanistan is that, well, now the priority for the U.S. national security strategy is a great power competition with China. And in order to deal more effectively with China, we need as much resources as we can garner. So I think from that perspective, the withdrawal from Afghanistan at least is partially incentivized and motivated by the desire to better compete with China. And given the Biden administration's focus on the multilateral coalition, I think the withdrawal from Afghanistan will certainly strengthen the U.S. ability to rally support and to coordinate positions to better and more effectively compete with China.
Yuen Sun is co-director of the East Asia Program at the Stimson Center in Washington. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Marco.
The vice president's trip comes not long after the U.S. announced it's getting a new military base in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. In Micronesia, an archipelago of more than 600 islands dotted across the Western Pacific, engaging with it is seen as part of the Biden administration's efforts to increase its footprint in Oceania. Details about the base so far are scarce, and as Ashley Westerman reports, some citizens of the Federated States are anxious about the idea.
Sam Ilisugam has lots of questions about the new military base.
How big? What kind of base? All those questions are still very much up in the air for us.
Ilisugam, who now lives in the U.S. territory of Guam, still has siblings and other family back in the Federated States of Micronesia, often referred to as FSM. He says the lack of transparency so far from the government is concerning.
Anytime there is a change to the land, you affect our identity as Native Islanders. This will alter the social landscape of our islands. Our islands are very, very small. Any tiny changes to our lifestyle will greatly affect us.
Ilisugam understands that the FSM needs the U.S. military for security, but
their presence in Okinawa, their presence here on Guam, their presence in other foreign places has kind of put us on alert.
From colonization and nuclear testing to land disputes and alleged crimes committed by American servicemen, the U.S. military's record in the Pacific is checkered, to say the least. FSM did not respond by deadline to a request by the world regarding how or if they plan to incorporate the public. But President David W. Penuelo has said that when he made the agreement to build the new base, it was in the interest of his people, particularly security interests, which are guaranteed by a very special relationship with Washington. Here he is in an interview with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
The Freely Associated States are squarely part of the homeland, so we're being protected by the United States under our Constitution.
FSM, along with Palau and the Marshall Islands, have had these special bilateral agreements with the U.S. for decades. They're renegotiated every few years. Through them, they receive hundreds of millions of dollars in aid, economic and military. The Compacts of Free Association not only allow citizens to join the U.S. military.
The most recent version of the Compact of Free Association requires the United States to defend the FSM and to gives it the right to use facilities, bases, sites
That's Satou Lemay, vice president of the East-West Center. Basically, this means the U.S. is their sole defender. Lemay says this puts them in a very unique position.
FSM, like other countries in the region, is straddling or managing its relations both with China and the United States, as both are China is increasingly active there.
So far, there's been no real reaction about the forthcoming base from Beijing, which has diplomatic relations with the Federated States of Micronesia. President Panuelo told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation he intends to manage this relationship.
The interest of our nation must come first, what is in the best interest of our citizens. And so the posturing of the United States and our country is not looking for a confrontation, but rather looking at deterrence and making sure that peace exists in our vast Pacific Ocean.
But Derek Grossman, a senior defense analyst with the RAND Corporation, says Washington is increasingly concerned about armed conflict with China.
They have a growing range to deploy these capabilities against U.S. interests in the Pacific. That's ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, bombers, surface fleets, as well as submarine assets.
Grossman says China's influence has expanded past its stronghold in the South China Sea, so the U.S. military is focusing on an area further into the Pacific.
These are new locations, along with Guam, with military bases already on Guam, that the U.S. could use in a future armed conflict against China.
The downside? All of these places are much further away from the U.S. The Federated States of Micronesia, for example, is nearly 3,700 miles from Hawaii. Grossman says this will likely make it more difficult for the U.S. to project its influence on the people in the region. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman.
The COVID-19 pandemic has been isolating for a lot of us, especially people most at risk of serious illness. Rising vaccination rates in countries like Canada have allowed some seniors to finally resume a more normal life, like seeing live music. Reporter Emma Jacobs went to a concert at a retirement community outside of Montreal and brought back this story.
Around 100 residents of a retirement home in the Montreal suburb of Brossard have come to hear a group of musicians called Taref Siriana. They ooh and ah when Naim Shanwar holds up his instrument, a 78-string canoon. He demonstrates how it can be played like a harp or strummed like a guitar. Taref Siriana plays music from Syria and other parts of the Middle East and the Balkans. The members of the group first met in jam sessions around Montreal and come from a variety of musical backgrounds. Shanwar taught canoon at the University of Homs in Syria before moving to Montreal. Omar Abu Afak is a classically trained violinist who once played with the Syrian National Symphony Orchestra. The accordionist Sergio Popa, originally from Moldova, seems to be able to play just about any genre. The Swiss cellist Noemi Braun, also originally trained in classical music. During the pandemic, funding became available here in Quebec for musicians to play shows for seniors. This helps musicians who lost their normal audiences and income and brings entertainment to isolated residents who earlier on sometimes watched from the balconies of their rooms. Resident Anne Turpin is thrilled.
It's fantastic. Because we were closed into our, we were locked up in our apartments for quite a while.
Some of the most deadly outbreaks in Canada spread in Quebec's long-term care homes, but retirement residences for people in better health have also had cases and public health guidelines have been strict. Vaccination rates have recently soared in Quebec, with the highest rates among seniors.
9.5. Here in the building.
Turpin and her friend Valerie Parent say 99.5% of the residents of this building are vaccinated.
We're looking forward for dancing.
Next, Parent says she's hoping for the return of line dancing.
Durant la pandémie, on a développé une offre virtuelle.
The head of programming here, Mariella Roland, says staff organized virtual programming over the past year, even virtual musical performances. But gatherings of this size only became possible in late July. Even the musicians are still getting used to playing in public again, says the accordionist Popa.
By staying home, it's just something, there was a click in the mind that it takes a bit to refresh. It's not something that we lost how to play, but it's just a bit, it's a bit new.
Bron, the cellist, chimes in to add that she enjoys performing now even more than she used to.
I think now even more, we are even more excited to give to people, you know, to exchange the energy. Mm-hmm. Something you miss for a couple of months, it's like, you know, it's like...
more than a couple of months.
The canoon player, Shanwar, says he likes playing for these residents a lot. Yeah.
Sometimes I prefer to play for them more than the other people, other ages. Because they respect, sometimes they respect our music. They know more, maybe.
The seniors are good listeners, he says, open to listen to all types of music. For The World, I'm Emma Jacobs in Montreal.
Western governments have closed their embassies in Afghanistan, but the UN compound in Kabul is staffed and operating. Linda Tom heads up public information for UNOCHA, the UN office that coordinates humanitarian affairs in Afghanistan. We reached her before the weekend, and she told the world's Carol Hills that the UN mission remains the same, regardless of who rules Afghanistan.
We are working on providing assistance to people in need, and we want to show people in Afghanistan that we have not abandoned them. We remain in Afghanistan.
But practically, how has your work been affected by the collapse of the Afghan government and now the Taliban as the new government?
Yes, of course, our work has been affected by the last, might I say, months of conflict. There was active fighting in many areas, so some of our work had to be temporarily suspended, but we're really working to try to restart those particular programs. And then there was some assistance that was ongoing because we had local agreements with the Taliban in some areas, and those programs continued.
How would you describe your agency's working relationship with the Taliban?
We have been engaging with the Taliban for years now, as we do speak to all the parties to the conflict. Of course, now the situation has changed and we'll need to adapt. But as humanitarians, we would say that, you know, we're neutral and we're impartial, and we need to continue to push for access to people in need, both men and women. And we also are advocating that aid workers have to be both men and women so that we can access people wherever the needs are.
And have you gotten any pushback from the Taliban about continuing to treat women, continuing to have female humanitarian workers, continuing to have Afghan girls go to school? Have you noticed any changes in that?
You know, it's a bit too soon to say. We're having those conversations right now. From our perspective, from the UN's perspective, from the humanitarian community's perspective, we absolutely say that women are needed in order for this country to work. And in our conversations, my understanding is that it's been mixed in different areas. So it's been an ongoing negotiation. But what's important is that we need to get assistance in areas where it has stopped or where it has stalled and restart those programs. But we have to do it in line with humanitarian principles.
We hear reports of extrajudicial killings by some Taliban fighters. We also know that kidnappings and murders of aid workers are not uncommon. How do you and your colleagues stay safe and still do your work?
The situation in Afghanistan is extremely challenging. It's particularly challenging for the people who live here. All civilians, they need protection, and we call on parties to protect civilians and also aid workers. Just in the beginning of this year, I think 25 aid workers were killed trying to provide humanitarian assistance to vulnerable people. So it's really, really important that we reinforce this message that both civilians, civilian infrastructure, and aid workers must be protected.
A lot of the focus is on getting Afghans out of Afghanistan. Your work, of course, is working with Afghans in Afghanistan who are not going anywhere. What are the most urgent needs you're seeing among the people you're working with?
It's really based on the assessments that we do. For example, for people who were recently displaced in Kabul, and we were able to identify about 17,500 people who need assistance. And what they need is that they need shelter. They need food. They need water and sanitation. And they needed things like kitchen items. And the reason why is that many of these people fled from urban areas really, really quickly, and they weren't able to bring anything with them. They probably just left, you know, with the clothes on their back.
Linda Tom is with UNOCHA, the UN office that coordinates humanitarian affairs in Afghanistan. She was speaking with The World's Carol Hills. Find more of our reporting on the evacuation from Kabul and the people impacted. That's all at our website, theworld.org. In Tokyo, it's time for round two of top-level international sports. The Paralympics opening ceremony was held today. Organizers are embracing a human rights campaign for people with disabilities.
So are the pedestals on ice?
And the pity tolerated.
We're not special. That's not what it's like.
That's a clip from a video for We the 15, meaning 15% of the world's population having disabilities. The stigma attached to disability changes when you watch the sport. That's according to Craig Spence, a spokesman for the International Paralympic Committee. As he says, these games will change your attitude toward disability. So let's get to the sports. More than 4,000 athletes competing across 22 events. The world's Bianca Hillier is on the Olympic and Paralympic Games beat for us. So, Bianca, we saw a few new sports at the Olympics this summer. Are any new sports showing up at the Paralympics?
Yeah, there are two new ones. Badminton and Taekwondo are on the Paralympic lineup for the first time. For badminton, Japan's own Yuma Yamazaki is a fan favorite to win both the doubles and singles events. And the Taekwondo competition is really stacked. You're going to want to be watching Amy Truesdale from Great Britain, who is a clear favorite for a medal this year. Mm. And also Bolor Erdenganbat from Mongolia. He's got a lot of credentials under his belt. He's currently ranked first in the world and is a four-time world champion, which has earned him nicknames like the Mongolian Monster and the Unbeatable Mongolian Fighter. And it's important to remember these badminton and taekwondo athletes have been at the top of their game for years and decades in some cases, but they've never gotten to compete on the Paralympic stage for such an international audience. And for some of them, a gold medal is kind of that last empty spot in their trophy case that they want to fill. So Tokyo 2020 is going to be a new and major opportunity for these athletes.
Yeah, that's exciting. Definitely going to be watching out for those new sports and players. But let's not forget the repeat athletes coming back to the Paralympics. Who are the reigning champs on your radar?
A lot to choose from here. First, there's Fanny Ilish, a swimmer from Hungary. At 16, she was the youngest athlete to represent her country at the 2008 Games, and Tokyo is her fourth time at the Paralympics, and she's only gotten better over the years. Wow. In 2020, she was even named Female Athlete of the Year by Hungary's Glamour magazine. I reached out to her after she landed in Japan, and she shared why the Paralympics and her sport, swimming, are so important to her.
At my very first swimming competition, I met for the first time people with same impairments. That was the point when I felt I found my group, my spot, and my goal in Tokyo is to finish as a medalist at the Paralympics.
As you can imagine, Marco, that's a goal I heard from a lot of athletes, including Brazilian swimmer Daniel Dias, who is South America's most decorated Paralympian ever, with 24 medals already to his name.
Whoa.
He's actually announced that he's calling it quits after Tokyo and retiring after a successful career. But he says he doesn't want his legacy to just be about his trips to the podium.
O que define cada de nós é o que está dentro de nós. E dentro de nós existe uma força muito grande, capaz de realizar grandes sonhos, grandes objetivos.
Speaking about Paralympians, Dias said, what defines each one of us is what is inside of us. And inside of us, there's a very strong force capable of achieving big dreams and big goals. Dias added that he wants his legacy to be about breaking the barrier of prejudice that sometimes surrounds Paralympians.
That would certainly make a mark. Are there sports, Bianca, included in the Paralympics that are not at the Olympics?
Yeah, there are two of them. The first is boccia, which is played by athletes with neurological impairments that impact their motor function. This is really similar to the Italian game of bocce. Athletes throw balls at a target on the ground and try to get the ball as close to the target as possible. Then there's also goalball. It's actually one of the oldest Paralympic sports and was the first sport specifically for athletes with visual impairments. Here, each team has three players who try to throw their ball into the opponent's net, which is a big net, kind of like a soccer net. Turkey and Lithuania took gold back in Rio in 2016, but Israel's women's team has made some serious strides since then, and they could possibly get their first goalball medal this summer in Tokyo.
Goalball and boccia. Looking forward to that and much more. A lot of action. The world's Bianca Hillier has been covering the Olympics and Paralympics for us. Bianca, thanks for raising the curtain.
Thanks so much, Marco.
The Paralympic opening ceremonies in Tokyo today had fireworks, dancing, and the iconic parade of athletes. No fans in the stands, of course. The husband of Vice President Kamala Harris was one of the dignitaries in attendance. You can check out the sights on our Instagram. Find us at theworld.org/Instagram. There have been several iterations of the Rolling Stones over the years, but drummer Charlie Watts was a steadfast stone for more than half a century, in the band from the start, on the beat to the very end. News came today that Charlie Watts has died in London, 80 years old. He dropped out of the Rolling Stones U.S. tour a few weeks ago to recover from a medical procedure. Watts was seen as something of the quiet Rolling Stone. As Charlie Watts said himself in 2008, he never felt the pull to be in the spotlight.
I mean, I don't like drum solos. I don't ever take them. I admire some people that do them, but I generally don't like them. It's not something I sit and listen to. I prefer drummers in the band, you know, playing with the band.
Charlie Watts came to the Rolling Stones as a rocker, but over the years he adopted the sensibility of a jazz drummer. In an interview with singer and Rolling Stones insider Marianne Faithfull a few years ago, she told me she was a regular at any show Charlie Watts put on with his jazz ensemble.
I love seeing sort of, you know, from a Stones concert to his own jazz concert. And then you see him at the end of the night backing up his own drums. You know, I love that.
In that spirit, we leave you with Charlie Watts' own band doing their cover of the Rolling Stones' Miss You.
So long, I've been sleeping all alone, Lord, I miss you. I've been hanging on the phone, I've been sleeping all alone, I want to kiss you.
The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.
I've been hanging on the phone, I've been sleeping all alone, I want to kiss you. Thank you.